Hey everybody, before we get into this episode, we just wanted to remind listeners that the Duress Crew Charity Raffle is online for the first time ever. We are currently, as of recording, at $320 raised via the internet, and we are looking for a stretch goal of $500, and at that point we will be pulling tickets for two signed playsets of foil duresses, shadow signed by Mr. Lawrence Snelly himself. By the time this comes out, there will be one more day to go in the charity raffle. It closes on Friday at midnight. So if you're interested in donating, please do so with the quickness. Let's hit this 500 goal and get two playsets of duress out there.
Hell yeah.
Welcome to the Hardcast. My name is Jay, and today I am your somewhat temporary host. Today I'm going to be joined by the usual favorites. We got Billy and Brad.
Yo.
Hey.
And today we got a pretty special topic, in my opinion.
That's just because you're driving.
Yeah, basically. But we're going to be talking about tournament prep. And getting a little bit more meta than just, hey, here's what you should play at the next event you play at. But we have, at the time that you're listening to this, there'll be the Duress Crew seasonal that's our, what, winter open?
Yep.
Forget what time of the year it is. So we have the winter open in a couple of days, and then we have LobsterCon coming up in a couple of months. And hopefully you are trying to get ready for those tournaments, and I want to talk about what you can do to get to be better prepared, both mentally, physically, and just want to get you in a state where you know really what you're getting into, whether you're a newer player or you're a seasoned player, either one, but get you into a position where you're better prepared and ready to just take on all the challenges that come. So,
yeah.
Hell yeah.
Jay wrote a nice episode for today. I am here for comedic relief and to get credit for all of Jay's wonderful takes.
Yes, yes. So anything that is really smart that I say, or at least that sounds smart, give Brad all the credit.
Yeah, you're going to have to preface it with, this is Jay speaking, and then go forward.
Yes.
What's up? I'm here to make sure that I don't fall into the perpetual piss baby trap that I always fall into. I always want to be like, oh, I've got a great idea, and then
Billy's here to learn.
I'm here to learn.
Yeah. He is taking notes. He is
I'm with you, dear listener.
Yes. So I think the first thing that I want to talk about with regards to tournament prep is setting goals. Everybody, you know, no matter what, you have goals, but they might not be something that you're really thinking about. Very often people will set those goals subconsciously and they're just, you know, showing up. I want to win.
Yeah, that's the default goal.
That's the default is usually something around that. But I think that it's very important to have realistic goals and to also be, to really prepare yourself in a way that is setting yourself up for success. What I mean by that is that if you just go in always saying, well, I just want to win, I just want to win, we all know it. Magic is a game of variance. Sometimes you're just going to mulligan down to four and have a shitty time. And if you aren't preparing yourself mentally, you're probably not going to have a fun time. So consciously, I want to make sure that people are preparing themselves in a slightly different way, not just saying I want to win, but setting goals for themselves in such a way that it's realistic. So if it is something that, like, I want to do well in a tournament, I want to top eight a tournament, I want to win a tournament, that's awesome. But you also have to make sure that you are realistic with yourself. Not everybody is setting foot in a tournament and preparing themselves in the best way to win a tournament.
Well, I mean, other people have different goals.
Yeah, and other people have different goals. And yeah, that's a very important thing as well, that you can have a goal to just, like, I want to have fun.
Yeah.
I want to play a deck that I love playing.
Yep.
I want to
develop a brew.
Yeah, I want to develop a brew. I want to
create ridiculous game states and like create, you know.
Oh, so stasis players.
Yeah. Or like, I don't know, like Warp World players, you know.
Pure chaos.
Yeah, I want to socialize.
So before we dive in, should we give a nice outline to the listeners of kind of the entire episode?
Yeah, sure. That's probably a good idea. So I first want to talk about goals, and specifically with relation to goals, your mindset, and how you can try and shape your mindset in such a way to optimize yourself for success. And I've heard way too many people that show up to a tournament and get paired into a poor matchup or whatever and just come out acting like a piss baby. And I don't think those people were setting themselves up for success in the first place. I think they were largely just putting themselves in a spot where they were going to fail and not have a good time. So we're going to talk about goals. We're going to talk about mindset. And then we're going to talk about the four aspects of a tournament. So much in the same way that everybody always gets taught about the five senses, where in reality we actually have far more than just five senses.
Sense of humor.
Sense of direction. Sense of balance. So but everybody's just taught about...
Hey, I thought I was the comedic relief.
Everybody's just taught that they have five senses. So much in the same way, if I spell out the four aspects of a tournament and you, dear listener, go, wait a second, he forgot about this one. Shut up.
He doesn't care.
I don't care. My version's the one that's going to get written in the textbooks for all of history. So
we're carving this into tablets.
Exactly. Yeah. We're carving this into tablets. So we're going to talk about the four aspects of tournament, which I guess we could run down real quick. It's going to be deck selection, strategic play, technical play, and then good old variance luck. And then after that, we're just going to talk about a little bit of self-care. Good old self-care.
I would like... Is that all?
Yeah, and that's everything.
I want to emphasize here, I don't think Jay is going to advocate for himself strong enough here. Jay is an extremely good player.
I think I'm mediocre at best.
Top 8 at LC. Two years ago. And the other thing, too, is that you participate in a form of magic that PM exists largely outside of, which is RCQ grinding.
That is true.
So in the same way that like a player might develop a brew over the course of like a season or across an idea in a Discord, like Jay is operating in a space that like PM players like don't fuck with,
and yeah, oftentimes they're not familiar.
They're not familiar with it. I haven't. The last PTQ I played in was in 2009, like Shard Zendikar standard. So I don't know how to fuck with this. So like hearing your perspective, and like your methodology, and you've won a couple RCQs, right?
Oh yeah. I've gone to two or three RCs now and done pretty middling. Mediocre at all of them, and very
making
humbling.
It there is the achievement, though.
Yeah, and you know, it's all a very humbling experience of you always will think that you are, you know, it's like every single college player in like football is, or like in high school, they're like better than everybody in the state, and then they go to college and eventually the pros, and it's like all of a sudden they are mincemeat. Like, they aren't shit.
Yeah, like my team won the county, and it's like, bro, like you're pretty like you might be able to walk on to D3.
Exactly. I definitely do have a different perspective than a lot of pre-modern players, and a good amount of the conversation today is probably going to be a little bit more competitive focused. However, I think that every pre-modern player can still glean something of importance from it. I think that having the correct mindset, having, you know, the ability to set goals no matter what they are, I think these are all really important things that you have to keep in mind in order to have a good time. I see far too many players that are currently kind of down on the format, and I think that a slight reorienting of their overall mental would be very beneficial.
Maybe even down on themselves too, you know?
Oh, for sure. For sure.
I think that this is a good topic as somebody who has also been pretty largely absent from large tournament scenes. It definitely took me a while to get a good feel of how I handled tournaments. And
big tournaments are very different than just playing Magic.
Yeah. So it took me a while to adjust to it and figure out how to lose and how to win and just how to have a good time and all that stuff. And, you know, not walk away from a tournament feeling horrible about it and just being able to come to terms and all that stuff. So,
Setting our expectations, like being realistic about how much work you're willing to put into it, or like identifying.
That's a really important thing that I think. So to kind of jump right in.
Yeah.
If you have a competitive oriented goal, I think one of the first things that you really need to ask yourself is, okay, so what does this require? What are the requisite steps to attain this goal?
And can we make this more specific? Let's say the goal is to top 16, to get published on LobsterCon.
Mm-hmm.
Top 32 LobsterCon. Will this derail your...
No.
Okay, so as a spine.
Yeah, I think...
We're trying to top 32 LobsterCon.
I think, you know, just saying top 32 LobsterCon is a decent goal. I do think that players will sometimes fall into the trap of getting too specific in their competitive goals of like, oh, I want to win LobsterCon this year. It's like, okay, well, there are so many things that have to go right.
Yeah.
Largely, if you talk to anybody who has ever won a big tournament, they got lucky a lot.
Yeah.
You might just not get lucky that day. And that doesn't mean that you failed in your goal.
Yeah.
So having a goal that you can accomplish outside, that you control all aspects of, I want to be fully prepared with a sideboard guide for all the matchups that I want to, that I'm expecting in the meta. I want to make sure that I'm happy in my deck selection and think that I'm picking something that is attacking the meta and puts me in a good position to win. I want to make sure that I'm prepared and have gotten all my technical play down through playtesting with people going up to the event. I think having those kind of sub goals are really important. Because they allow you to then have a bad day or even just a fine day with regards to variance, that you can still feel like you accomplished your goals.
Mm-hmm.
And not, even if you didn't accomplish the big goal that you were looking for of, I wanted to win LobsterCon or whatever it may be.
As you're talking about it now, I'm sort of thinking that like, one of the things you can control is your N of like, you have N trials.
Mm-hmm.
So it's like, maybe it's like top eighting, like a Duresque seasonal
for sure. That,
because then you're now, I'm realizing as you're talking that like everything you just spoke about was like things I can control.
Mm-hmm.
Like I can like, you know, I'll be like, hey, like if I bring you a Dunks, will you show up to the weekly an hour early so we can jam this matchup and get your advice or whatever? And that's something that I can control. But like, I can also control my N.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, like how many tournaments do
I show up? Yeah, N being your sample size.
Exactly.
I think having that kind of long-term goal of like, I want to just top eight a Duresque regional is a much better goal than just, hey, like this one tournament I need to win.
Yeah.
Because it's just, there's a very good chance it's not going to happen.
Yep.
And you don't want to feel like you failed yourself. Mm-hmm. Because that's really going back to what I was saying about, you're setting yourself up to fail. And you want to keep those goals long-term that are still reasonable, still able to be accomplished, so that you have that feeling of success when you finally do reach those goals. But don't put too much stake into a single tournament because there's a good chance that you're just going to feel like you let yourself down, and then you spiral into feeling like you wasted time and all this stuff that is really, really negative, and you don't want to go down that path.
Yeah. You might even just think you're a shit player afterwards.
Very true. And there have been several, there have been many tournaments that I've just, you know, 0-2 dropped and been like, geez, I suck. And then I'll go and, you know, do really well in a tournament the next weekend. And it's like, okay, so if I'm basing my entire self-worth on a single tournament, I can't do that. It's just not healthy mentally.
That is not what Magic is for, and that is not, it is really not what PM is for.
For sure. And that kind of leads to some other goals that you might have, which maybe you're not even, you know, you don't care about just winning or playing a specific deck or whatever, but maybe you're just there for the gathering.
Yeah.
And that is totally okay. That is it's something that I think more people need to enjoy, is just like, a huge reason why we go to these tournaments is just to hang out with friends. And but
you can break those down into, like, so to use that as an example, you mm-hmm. just like using, I'm listening to your methodology here. So it's like, okay, my goal is a gathering.
Mm-hmm.
My goal is to buy Carl a drink.
Mm-hmm.
And my goal is to lose some games at AAA so I can give out like some cool cards I've scribbled all over.
Mm-hmm.
Or my goal is to make sure that I go out every night with a different group of people or something mm-hmm. like that. So you can break these down and be using the same framework of breaking it down.
Mm-hmm.
Like, I want to make sure that I get an Airbnb and get my four people from my play group. I want a full car this year
mm-hmm.
from Rochester mm-hmm. or wherever. Like, so you can apply the same framework of like breaking it down into the stuff you can control.
Oh yeah.
To the same, using the same methodology.
For sure. Now, something I kind of want to just spin back and throw to you guys is, out of curiosity,
mm-hmm.
how do you guys see your own short-term and long-term goals with regards to Magic? And it can be specific to tournaments or Magic more broadly. But yeah, like, what do you guys see as your own personal goals?
Get Mox Diamond banned.
Okay.
I'm just kidding. No, I would say that my personal goal is, I am, like, the way that I derive joy, like, the whole, like, Duress Crew stuff is, like, kind of separate, like, content creation, tournament organizing, but speaking as a player,
mm-hmm.
for me, the thing is that I'm realizing now, like, not to turn this into a therapy session, but I'm realizing how much of it is external validation.
Oh yeah, for sure. And a lot of it is.
Yeah.
But
my goal is to achieve recognition for deck development.
Mm-hmm.
That's what's important to me, is like, come up with an idea, keep it in my pocket, tune it up enough
mm-hmm.
that like somebody better than me can go win a tournament with it.
Yeah.
Like, I'm good. I'm not great.
No, hell yeah. Yeah. No, I actually want to, sorry, Brad, to interrupt, but something I want to really harp on is that so many people have that goal of external validation, of wanting to not just necessarily be great, but be seen as great.
Yeah.
And be seen as a winner or whatever it may be. But they have that as a goal, and the end result appeals to them, but the journey does not. And yeah. Something that is really important when you're setting goals for yourself is saying, is this what is fun for me? And if the journey isn't what's fun for you, then you really need to reassess. Because, like, for example, if you want to be a great player, that's going to mean jamming mirror matches of maybe you really don't enjoy PM right now. You really don't like Parallax Tide, but you want to be seen as one of the great PM players in the region, the country, the world, whatever.
There's a big mouthful of FITFO between that.
Exactly. Those two things are not really compatible with each other. You're probably going to want to be playing a Tide deck or something that interacts favorably with Tide, or at the very least just practicing the deck to get better reps. You know, getting reps on a deck is always one of the best ways to get better at playing against it. So if you really just don't want to be jamming matches that involve Tied, then you're probably not going to get to that point of being one of the greatest PM players right now. Mm-hmm. So if you aren't enjoying that journey, then maybe you need to reassess why your goal is what it is. So sorry to kind of derail there for a second, but Brad,
you should be.
I am.
Just kidding.
I am. But Brad, so what about you? What are any nice hits? What are any goals you have?
So I would say that I was similar to Billy, where I was looking to receive validation for the time and, you know, the time that I had put into Terrageddon basically is is where my pre-modern journey has been for the past year and a half or whatever. I think that I've gotten to a point where I'm content with, I guess, like my reputation and my name being associated with the archetype and everything, that I'm not so much on that journey anymore. I'm honestly these days, I'm really just going to the tournaments more and more to like hang out and see familiar faces and enjoy the gathering. And I feel like the Massachusetts like scene is really taking shape and becoming more and more tight knit, where like I go to these tournaments now and I see all these familiar faces and I say what's up and hey to all these people and have like, you know, conversations here and there. And it just really is feeling more and more like a community as time is going on, because we've all been spending, you know, the past almost 2 years together in these venues, the same people coming through and forming these connections and everything. So I, at this point, I'm quite content to go to these tournaments just to see everybody, shake hands, say what's up, have conversations, catch up. And also, I do want to top eight, generally, is like where I want to be. Like, I don't even really care anymore that much about winning the entire thing, but I do like playing well and doing well and getting into the top eight.
For sure.
That's definitely part of it. But, I mean, at this point, you know, putting Duress Crew aside, again, as Billy said, it's really just a lot about going to the tournament and enjoying myself and enjoying the time there. Not getting stressed out about losing has been like a big thing that I've been learning how to do.
Mm-hmm.
And especially, especially when you lose bad matchups, just like being okay with it.
For sure.
And I think that that's something that that's a positive that has come out of the Duress Crew data for me, is really knowing my weak matchups so that when I get paired into them, not only am I enjoying the puzzle of like solving how do I fix this in real time, but also just being accepting of like, you know what, I got O2'd by elves in round one, shit happens, whatever. Yep. Like
you get paired into a bad matchup or whatever, and it happens.
Yep.
No, I think that
Billy wants to.
Yeah.
I'm realizing that there, when you're saying like about the Duress Crew stuff, I'm also like realizing not just like the TO content creation stuff, but also like I want to see the glory of the crew. Like that is like by far the most important thing for me.
Yeah.
That it's like if it's no question, if it's like if I can't make top eight and somebody got paired from my team got paired down into me, of course I'm scooping them in. Like, no way.
Collusion. Like, tournament, my tournament integrity.
Absolutely.
No!
And, like, no. It's like, as soon as I get my, like, third loss or whatever, it's like, what do you need? You need a Clif Bar, you need coffee, you need water, you need nicotine. Like, what do you need? Like, and then it's like, and everybody does.
Being a team player,
yeah. And everybody does it, too. Mm-hmm. So that you can support. And then you start, yeah. Scouting.
Oh yeah, no, and helping helping your friends out to do whatever you can to put them in a position to succeed.
Yeah.
Where maybe you didn't yourself, but I shouldn't even say it like that, because again, not doing well in a tournament doesn't mean you didn't succeed. You can feel like, again, like you came prepared, like you checked off all the boxes for how you prepared yourself for a tournament. And then just like you said, you know, you ran into a bad matchup the first couple of rounds, shit happens. And I think losing, being able to lose kind of segues us perfectly into the next thing that I want to talk about, which was mindset, which goes pretty hand in hand with goals. And just keeping yourself positive and orienting yourself towards those goals. Everybody has, you know, a mindset, obviously. Everybody.
I have a Sigma
grindset. The Sigma grindset, yes. There you go. Ben can splice in the fucking funk or whatever.
Have you ever heard of the Ligma grindset?
Ooh, can you show me?
Once we get off the mic.
But I think it's important that people are kind of aware of what that mindset is that they have. So if you are, again, kind of competitively oriented with your goals, something I think a lot about is the, I don't know if you guys played like, you know, any video games back on like Xbox Live back in, you know, mid-2000s or whatever, playing, you know, the Call of Duties or whatever.
I played some StarCraft ladder.
The toxic mentality of seeing anybody that is below you as a scrub,
That's a big thing in Rivals right now, right? Isn't that like the thing about Marvel Rivals? Is that it's like...
I think that's just every PvP game ever. Okay. Yeah. It just incurs that mentality of everybody below you...
Dota's really bad like that.
Sucks. Right?
Yeah.
But if somebody is better than you...
They're all toxic.
They're sweaty and they're, you know, they're a tryhard.
Yeah.
And that mentality is just so, so negative and so toxic that immediately dismissing, well, somebody beat me, that's because they're just a sweaty and that's a bad thing. But if I beat somebody, it's because they suck and that's also a bad thing. And it's like, you can't have a mindset like that.
You can't?
No.
I've been there for years.
I mean, yes, you can.
Never left.
You can.
Never
left. But it's just, it's, if you want to feel like you are fulfilled in after a tournament or whatever, or after a loss is really the most important thing, understand that what were the steps that you had control over that you could take to put yourself in the best place to win, and did you do that? And if not, what can you improve? And if you did, that's okay too. You can just sometimes have, you know, the cards don't fall your way, and that's okay. I think we'll talk about luck and everything in a little bit, but something that I think is really important for a lot of people to understand is that, like you said, looking at the data, how it's, you know, it really helps, like, knowing that when you lose a bad matchup. And the way I see it is, it's not just the bad matchups, though. It's also, like, you know, a good matchup is very often 60-40. That means 4 out of 10 times you're losing.
Yeah.
Right.
You know, like, I think a lot of people don't necessarily, you know, they see a 60-40 matchup and they think that means that they win 95% of the time. It's like the classic, anybody that played XCOM, where, strategy video game where everything is presented to you in terms of odds. And players, I believe that there was actually a comment from the developers about how players always would get furious about seeing something that was, say, like a 95% chance and then having it fail and being like, how could this happen?
Yeah.
It's like, well, we that's a 1 in 20 chance. So, right. Like, yeah. Out of 20 times, it's going to happen once.
Like, if I had a 60-40 coin and that was our matchup, like, and it was just flipping, like, how long would it take for us to, like, be really certain to tell the difference between a 60-40 coin and a 50-50 coin? And each of those coin flips takes us a match period to figure the fuck out.
Like, for sure.
50 minutes to do one coin flip.
It is, players in general are really, really, or humans in general are really, really bad at estimating percentages. You know, they think, they see a 70% matchup and they think that means it's 100%. And then, you know, they lose and they get furious. And it's understanding that, you're going to lose. It's going to happen. The good matchups, you're still going to lose. You know, 3 out of 10 times or whatever. So
somebody's got to get upset, you know?
Exactly.
And not actually upset, yeah, but somebody, the upset has to happen, yes, sometimes.
Oh yeah, 100%. And that's just kind of the way that it is. But I think it's important to understand kind of where your head is at. And just like, if you're putting too much stock in any single game, take a step back. Ask why. Is, you know, are you just seeking, you know, validation for a, you know, childhood of being bullied or whatever? You know, not speaking from experience or anything, but, you know.
Whose therapy session is this?
Yeah,
whose
therapy? Yeah, this isn't, I don't know what you guys are talking about. But I think that kind of brings me to what I said I would term as the four aspects of a tournament. These are kind of just, I don't know how to put this, but this is like everything there is. If I had to break down what mattered in a tournament, this would be, everything would fall under these four categories. The first one.
Crew fit.
Yes, yes. How everybody is coordinating their outfits, how they look, who's wearing sunglasses indoors, who's not.
Ski masks.
Ski masks.
Bucket hats.
All very important.
Yeah.
Sunglasses are a hard fit.
Oh, yeah. Hell yeah. First thing, so when does a tournament start? Is it at round one when the judge says, fight, begin?
1 year before.
Yes, when your training regimen starts.
Yeah, at birth.
Yes, at birth. Yeah, that's probably the most
accurate. When you were a twinkle in your father's eye.
I would say that a tournament starts, and if you want to get prepared for a tournament, tournament starts at deck selection. I think so many people do not understand how important deck selection is. Every single matchup that you have is going to be partially determined by what deck you choose to play. And if you are, again, going to a more competitive-oriented goal, if you are trying to win, I guess is just the simpler way to put it, you should be putting yourself in the best position to win with a good deck. I think far too many people say, well, I'm a burn player. I play burn. And right now, just using it as an example, burn's really poorly positioned in the meta. And I'm not even necessarily saying that is true, although it probably is kind of true. Yeah, it does seem kind of, does seem to kind of be true. But anyways, if you say that, like, oh, I'm a burn player, therefore I have to play burn, before the tournament's even started, you're already putting yourself at a serious disadvantage compared to everybody else. So I don't think that, and this is something actually we talked about before the podcast started, that in some cases it might just be people almost setting themselves up to fail to have a convenient, you know, self-sabotaging themselves to have a convenient excuse. I've certainly done this before, where, oh, well, I have to play this deck, and then you play this deck, and then, no shit, you do poorly. Oh, well, it was because I played this deck. Well, if your goal is to do well, play a good deck.
So, can I...
Yeah.
Thank you. I want to talk about... Hang on. When do we get to talk about my Piss Baby era? Because I think this is, like, super pertinent, perhaps not to this point, but definitely to this episode.
Sure. No. If you want to split into it right now. Talk about it.
Hi, I'm Billy.
And I'm a piss baby.
And I'm a piss baby.
Are you still?
No.
So no. I was a piss baby.
I was a piss baby.
End of an era.
So when I was like relatively new into PM, mm-hmm. I started on just like straight green white, like threshold style with mulch, Terrigan, whatever, solid at the time tier 2 deck. And I got too enchanted by brewing, and I was like very misaligned with mm-hmm. what my goals were and what my like unnatural urges were.
Mm-hmm.
And I wanted to like, I hear all these stories about like the thing that we celebrate in PM is having like a vision and being like, oh, this person had this great idea and they blew the meta wide open and they invented a deck and like you debuted at LobsterCon. And I showed up with like the Terravor Werebear build. It was like 5-color Terrageddon with Lantax. And everybody was like, oh, standstill is the thing to do. I showed up with 4 main deck duresses and I annihilated Lancel. Just absolutely fucking shredded them.
Well, you also had 4 Geddens, 4 Cataclysms, right?
I had 3 Geddon, 4 Cataclysm.
Yeah.
Because I didn't really understand a lot about the format then. I was also a much worse player. I'm like probably the best I've ever been at Magic right now.
Yeah.
And I went 2-6. And I was like losing to people who were like on vacation with their like family members who were obsessed with PM. And like they were just tagging along and I was like losing to them because I was like just so misguided. And I went to the Star City Games Hartford and like brought another brew and I'm like, I'm gonna play Weathered Wayfarer and I'm gonna feed a smokestack with it and I'm gonna make up for the fact and I'm gonna play Burning Wish. And it was like cool. I went like 3-3, but then like Duress Crew had 5 members in the top 8 and I was like, I'm like about as good as a couple of people in there. Like, I want to be up there.
Yeah.
Like, what the fuck? Like,
very visibly dejected outside.
Yeah. And like, I was like pissing and crying.
Railing B&Ms. And,
yeah. Just being a huge brat. And like, eventually I discovered Mono Green Ponza and like really got involved in a deck and deck development and like picked a deck and stopped dicking around like and fought tracking my data, blah, blah, blah. So. And then, like, my entire mindset shifted about, like, follow the data, play the cards and decks that are winning. So I hope this was not too much of a tangent.
But, no.
But this was, like, a huge thing in my pre-modern experience was, like stop trying to be smart. Stop trying to be tricky. You can do something creative and new, but you have to have the data to support that choice.
Yep.
Because if your goal isn't to win with evidence-based data, then your goal has to be data collection. And I was doing data collection, like first steps of data collection over and over and over again with different decks, but I was not following good data. I was just like, oh, that sucked. I'll try something else. And like not, my goal, my process was scientific, but my goal was competitive, which were not aligned. And I was bummed out for like 6 months on PM.
Yeah.
My piss baby era, we call it. So thank you for the tangent.
Yeah, no, of
course. But I think that offers context.
I think that something that's really important that I want to clarify and something I was saying is that it's not impossible. If your goals are to win, I think deck selection is such an important thing. But if your goals could be, I want to win with a brew.
Yep.
You know, those could be your goals. But then everything else and your entire mindset needs to be readjusted accordingly.
Well, that's a parlay. That's a two-variable parlay.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Exactly.
Which is in like there's a reason why parlays have huge payouts because they don't fucking hit that often.
Very true. That is so very true. So if you want to succeed and you want to be the best, you want to win a tournament, you want to top 8, whatever it may be, if that's what you want, then have a plan for the meta. If you're lazy and you're like, well, Jay, just tell me what deck to play. Okay, well, using some of the data from the beautiful Duress Crew data project,
PDAP,
which is available at data.duresscrew.com, I would say that you're probably best off playing
Terrageddon.
Some variation of either Terrageddon, Mono Blue, Dreadnought, or Replenish. I would say those are pretty clearly the tier one decks right now. If you don't want to play one of those, that's fine. But you're probably not putting yourself in the best position to win a tournament before the tournament has even started. Now, if you don't think that, you know, you don't want to play one of those decks, and that's fine. The other idea is kind of, there's two ways to attack a meta. There is play the broken deck, which in this case would be one of those three. Or there is play one of the decks that beat the best deck. If you think...
What about play the deck that you like?
And that's
where
totally...
Where does that fall
that's
into this?
And that's a... That falls under the goal of I want to be playing the deck that I enjoy playing and I want to have fun. And that's totally valid. But if your goal is to just top eight an event or, you know, do really well at LobsterCon or whatever, there are going to be metas where you should objectively be playing a deck that you may not enjoy.
Interesting. See, because my personal experience has been that if I don't fully enjoy the deck, I feel like I get worse results when playing it. I feel like it's easier to become dejected and frustrated and just like feel like you're not having a good time. And to me, that is... It's like deck selection is almost twofold, where it's like you should be playing, you know, if your goal is to go in and win, you should be choosing the best deck, but you should also be choosing the best deck that you enjoy playing.
For sure. And I think that everybody has strengths and weaknesses. You definitely want to take those into account. Although I would give some amount of pushback to any player that says, oh, I don't play control decks, or I don't play... you know, aggressive decks or whatever that may be, because most likely they just are comfortable playing whatever deck that they like to play. And that comfort is probably shoehorning them into being a worse player.
That's fair.
Because I think one of the most important things about getting better at Magic, and this is probably one of the best the most important things, is that if your goal is to do well, or even if it's not, one of your goals should be to be constantly improving and to be getting better at Magic. Because especially if you want to have any amount of success, you're most likely not just the best player in the world right now. You know, if you are, then all right. Hi, Brian Seldon. Thanks for listening to the podcast.
Yeah.
But like for everybody else, we have some amount of, or in most of our cases, a large amount of growth that is needed to reach our theoretical peaks.
Can I just say quick too? I think that like the whole idea of saying like, I'm not a control player, I'm a this player, is also going to kneecap you, because it seems like especially in pre-modern, you need to be flexible in 100%. The way that you are playing decks. And maybe I'm speaking more from personal experience with Terrageddon, but you know, I see it in other decks as well. Depending on the matchup, you might have to play the control,
for sure.
Might have to play the beatdown, you might have to play a game plan where like, you know, you play control early and then like switch on a dime and like try and close it out. Like it especially in pre-modern, it feels like you need to be multifaceted and be able to play different elements and different aspects of the game.
For sure.
I want to speak to the whole constant improvement thing, and just I think that can apply to like you used the like win maxing framework for that, but like same thing, it's like I want to make sure, if your goal is like a social thing, like I want to make sure I like run into like K-Run. I met him at LC last year, I hope I run it, you know, I'm gonna make sure that I like shake his hand and say what's up to him. If it's a social goal, or like, oh, I had a dead night, so I'm going to make sure that I'm constantly improving by like, I'm going to make sure that I eat well and like sleep properly so that I can like maximize my social time. Or like maybe I was like rude to somebody and I want to like get on better terms with them or what have you. Or if your goal is brewing, like, oh, this year I'm still on my brew train. I'm going to tighten up my like data collection, or I'm going to like get better at Excel. Or I'm going to, like, see what, I don't know, ChatGPT can do for me for, like, my data collection project, brewing or whatever. So it's not just the goal of constant improvement is not strictly limited to win-maxing.
Yeah. Oh, yeah, for 100%. It's, I think no matter what area of Magic your goals are set in, the idea of always trying to improve yourself is... unanimous throughout. I think moving back to deck selection, I think in general, if you're not looking at a meta and saying, all right, I want to play either the broken deck or I want to be playing something that specifically attacks the broken deck, like, just as an example, some people have been talking about, like, some of the mono black decks as having good matchups against kind of the big three tier one decks. Maybe that's something to look at. If you're not trying to play one of those options, then that's fine. That's totally okay. But be reasonable in your goals. If you aren't setting yourself up for the optimal, if you're not setting yourself up for the best chance possible of winning an event, then maybe that's not where your goals should be. Because, like we said, it's you want to make sure that you enjoy the journey, but if that's just not what you have fun doing, then, you know,
There's a degree of self-honesty to this.
Yes, exactly.
Like the Piss Baby era came about because what I enjoyed was my metrics of success were not matching what I enjoyed and
exactly.
Between what I did, what I enjoyed, and what I was doing, they weren't in alignment, and my diaper was very wet.
Yeah. So if you're sitting down being like, I'm going to win this tournament, and then you are like, and I'm going to play Red White Rifter, be honest with yourself.
Yeah.
Are you really putting everything into winning that tournament? Now, again, you could have the goal of, well, I want to do really well and put Rifter on the map. That's fine. Yeah. But like you said, with the parlays, it definitely, you have to accept that it's going to be a hell of a lot harder.
Yeah, or I want to play the deck I qualified in a PTQ with in 2001.
Mm-hmm.
Like, that's a cool goal. Like, oh yeah. I want to experience historical decks.
Hell yeah.
Like, oh, XYZ was my favorite player. I want to play his gold border deck 75 for 75 at LC. I heard he's showing up. I'm going to get him all signed by, or like, I don't know, some shit like that.
Yeah.
Like, you can have different goals, but be honest with yourself about what your goals and your behaviors and your metrics of success are.
Absolutely. Final note about deck selection. And I think this is really important to kind of stress, that card availability obviously can be an issue. In many cases, people might be like, oh, I only have this deck, that's why I have to play it. And I get it, but at the same time, I really implore you that the pre-modern community is so chill. Everybody is so nice. I've lent out decks at multiple tournaments. And if anybody is like, hey, I want to play this, and they either post in the Discord or tweet it, somebody or whatever, most likely you can probably get those cards.
If you were a stranger and you let me hold on to your like big boy trade binder, I would lend you a lot.
Oh yeah, 100%.
Don't ask at 8 a.m. the day of the tournament.
And that's the thing. Yes, yeah. If you are going to try and borrow cards, first off, proxy up the deck, play some matches with your friends, get some reps in, but you don't need the cards necessarily to get reps. And then, yeah, just don't message somebody asking to borrow cards the morning of the tournament. That's very rude. Don't do that.
Yeah. My MO is always like, you know, multiple days ahead, I'm trying to get all of my stuff locked in and know exactly what I need. And if I need to borrow things, like I don't want to make it super inconvenient for people because people are busy.
For sure.
And it's like, if you're asking on Friday night and the tournament's on Saturday, like, people are doing shit. They have lives outside of Magic. And it's like, you know, Give a nice little grace period when you're asking for favors.
So, next aspect of a tournament that I think is important, strategic play. So, I kind of broke down play in general into two aspects.
So, can I just say I'm excited for this? Because I feel like all of these podcasts talk about strategic and tactical and whatever the fuck, and I personally sit there and I'm like, I have no idea what these people are talking about.
So hell yeah. So let's
interested to learn right now.
Let's get into it. So I think this is pretty consistent with how most other people would define it. Strategy, so I break everything down into strategic play and technical play. Strategic play is your big picture stuff. Strategic play is knowing in a matchup what cards are important. What are the ones that are irrelevant that you can just ignore? It's figuring out what matters, knowing what sideboard cards can swing a matchup. What are the common play patterns in a matchup, and how can you disrupt or direct the match towards or away from those lines to give yourself the best chance of winning? All of this stuff that they, you know, strategy is generally figured out not during the game. It's the kind of stuff that you can go through your head of, okay, how does a typical game of Terrageddon versus whatever, Landstill, how does that typical match play out?
The most important thing is getting an Armageddon to resolve.
I would agree.
If an Armageddon resolves, that I think that is the single spell resolution that is most highly correlated with a W.
100%. And so the important sideboard cards are probably cards that will help push that through, whether if you're playing an Orm's Chant version, you can really hammer through an Armageddon. Knowing how you can, get to a point in the game where you can possibly double spell with going Geddon, they counter it, and then Geddon again, forcing them to, to have that second counter or whatever.
Setting up a Wayfarer so you can get double port. Yeah.
100%. So, blue.
Yep.
Generally, strategy is the kind of stuff that you want to be figuring out beforehand. And this is another way that you can prepare for a tournament, is saying, okay, how am I going to win these matchups? Mapping out a sideboard guide is a huge thing for strategy. Being able to offload a lot of your decisions, and this is a really important thing, we can talk about heuristics. So heuristics, Billy, actually, could you explain what a heuristic is?
To me,
yep.
A heuristic.
Not to put you on the spot, I apologize, but.
I
grill them.
This is my working definition of a heuristic. A heuristic or a heuristic.
European style.
Yeah.
Very nice.
It is a mental shortcut for, it's a function that instead of having to necessarily parse out something super difficult, you are looking for either early or easily recognizable indicators. And what a heuristic is, it is the function by which you turn those early or easily recognizable indicators into data that guides your behavior.
Exactly. So heuristics are super, super important in Magic.
Was I right?
That was excellent. And I think just the phrase mental shortcut is probably the best way of really capturing what they are. So to give an example, say you're playing Burn. And
I don't play that deck.
Fair.
Just say you are.
I'm playing Burn.
And you have...
The temptation to make.
And you have both Jackal Pup and Mog Fanatic in your deck.
Okay.
On the play...
Yeah.
Do you want to play Jackal Pup or do you want to play Mog Fanatic first?
I'm on the blind and
on the play. In the blind, you don't know...
Come on, give him a harder question.
I think I want to play Pup first.
I think that I'm not a Burn player. I believe that's probably correct. Burn players can roast us in the comments or whatever if that's wrong, but I believe that's 100% correct.
That's your best play turn one with Burn.
But when you're in a match playing Burn and you open up a hand that has Mountain, Jackal Pup, Mog Fanatic, you don't want to sit there and think in the moment, okay, which one of these, when you're in that position of being on, on the play in the blind, not knowing what your opponent's on, you want to be able to just go Mountain Pup, go ahead. Because you know ahead of time, if I have these two one drops available to me, which one am I going to play?
Mm-hmm.
So this essentially offloads that decision making. It's a strategy. It's figuring out what your strategy is beforehand, before you ever get into the match, and knowing what you're going to make. Now, there are always going to be kind of deviations from your heuristics. Knowing that if your opponent is on the play and they go Forest Llanowar Elf pass, and you sit there, are you still going Mountain Jackalpup? Probably not. I'd say more often than not, you're going Mog Fanatic, shoot your elf, pass.
Yeah.
Those aren't decisions that you necessarily have to have, that you have to sit and think about and waste not only precious clock time, but also we all do have a mental battery.
Yeah.
You know, there is so much, something that, and I bet you really figured this out since, Brad, you said that you hadn't been to many like long tournaments before. By the end of the day of a long tournament, you are cooked.
Absolutely gassed.
You are. It is a marathon. So having the stamina to offload decisions in such a way that you can minimize how much of your mental battery that those decisions are taking, to just kind of autopilot through them, you can then save your mental battery for the actual decisions that matter. Probably the best analogy that I can give to this is in chess, there are what's called book openings, which are, you know, predetermined, or not predetermined, but strategy that is from the very beginning of a chess game that people have already largely mapped out.
Mm-hmm.
People know what to, you know, how to counter certain openings. And obviously once the game has gotten to a sufficient point past the initial few moves, then that's where the actual
game begins.
Exactly.
Would you say that's when the tactical play begins?
Not necessarily. I think strategy is still, I'm not a chess player, but I think strategy is still very, very important, and big picture knowing how you want the game to develop.
Okay.
It's called out of book.
But yes, yeah. Once you get out of book.
Yeah, they mark it in the chess notation, Brad. In certain tournament reports, they will occasionally include the line out of book, because there are some openings that are so famous and so well researched,
mm-hmm.
that when somebody like
deviates from it,
they will write OOB in the notation, just be like, hey, like, you thought this was like standard whatever play.
Yeah.
Like, we're going to let you skip ahead. Like, this is where it gets interesting. And it will show to the reader, like, hey, that move didn't really seem that good. And then you're like, oh, well, they're actually, like, shooting from the hip at this point. I mean, they're all smarter than me and do better, you know, theory, blah, blah, blah.
Yeah.
Yeah.
This is when the butt plug really starts vibrating.
True.
Just buzzing.
Very, very good. Very, very nice. Very nice.
Out of butt.
So you're preparing for your tournament, and you've worked on how to attack the meta through your deck selection. You've worked on your strategy, figuring out your sideboard mapping, figuring out how you want, you know, playing out games in your mind and how those games are going to develop, figuring out heuristics so that you can offload decisions. But then we get to technical play. So this is kind of the other half of the coin. To strategy and strategic play. Technical play is, I think, probably best summed up in don't forget your fucking triggers.
Mm.
Technical play is the ability to actually do a lot of it's going to be, you know, your dexterity of just playing crisp, but not missing triggers. Making, when, you know, somebody attacks, making good blocks, and, you know, not failing to see an onboard combat trick that your opponent has access to. So, you know, you fail to account for the fact that you can block here thinking that you'll just eat their creature, and then they
have like sacrifice, and then they,
even on board, like, they sacrifice their Mog Fanatic to deal an extra point of damage, and sure, that kills your guy. It's
you're in round two of Rochester, and you're sick of getting fucking trade winded every fucking turn, and then you finally draw swords and you just point it at the untapped trade wind.
Yeah, you get blown out.
And then they just return it to their hand. Yeah. And then you scoop.
You just out.
Yeah. Ew. Yep.
Would you say that shuffling and stuff like that kind of comes into tactical as well?
If you want to convince your opponent that you're a window-licking glue eater, pile shuffle. Oh, it's a great tactical play.
Hey.
Yeah, they will be convinced that you're a fool.
I will say that pile shuffling is a fantastic way to count your library. And that's the only
between
thing.
Rounds. Yes.
At the beginning of the round, it's fine. Yeah. Once.
But I count my riffle shuffles. If you pile shuffle in front of me, I will count my riffle shuffles and get into the 50s or 60s. Before you finish your pile shuffle, and I'll do.
I don't pile shuffle anymore.
Good,
but
yeah.
To answer your question, yes, I think a lot of the dexterity aspects of the game would fall under technical play. I think that just being clean and precise and intentional, technical play is going to be a lot of the stuff that is in the moment. It's the smaller decisions. It's the small ball stuff, which. To be fair, a lot of games are won and lost on small edges that are gained through tight technical play. You know, you miss a squee trigger at the beginning of your turn.
That's a big one.
That's a big one. And all of a sudden, you're down a card, basically. Yeah.
Is sequencing part of tactical
play? Oh, 100%. Yeah, 100%.
Like sequencing the correct lands and like not getting my own port, that type of thing.
Yeah. I think that... technical play is probably the thing that, you know, so when it comes to, if I could just take a step back and say how, for this entire episode, if I had to sum up everything of like, how do you prepare for a tournament? Fucking practice, dude. That's just the simplest thing is if you want just a simple answer, it's practice. It's if you get more. The more times you just touch cardboard, the better you're going to be.
Deck touchers.
I think that... no, I lost my train of thought. I think that just getting pure reps in is always going to help. But specifically with regards to technical play, I think it's probably the kind of not the only but the best way to get to improve yourself. You know, there's ways you can improve, like we talked about with strategy, you know, whether it's reading Michael J. articles or whatever, or just listening to podcasts. You know, that's a great way of getting better strategy.
Is naming shock instead of lightning bolts with a meddling mage technical play?
Yeah, I would think so. Okay. I think and there's
I'm just trying to grasp these concepts.
I think there's tons of you know, there is some ebb and flow to strategy and technical play. I don't think everything necessarily falls, you know, there's some gradation between the two where I think naming the right thing on meddling mage is probably in the moment you could say technical play, but knowing
your heuristics,
but knowing what is important in the matchup is very important from a strategic level.
Yeah.
So it's not necessarily the most perfect.
I think I have a fair definition for this.
Okay.
All right. So the strat. All right. So if the goal is to win, strategy is identifying what turns into a win. So we'll stick with Terrigen and Land still because it's the only thing I know. So strategy is, okay, so I want to win. What is the thing that makes me win? The strategy is, okay, my strategy is to stick a Terrigen. That's my long-term goal. My tactical goal is how do I get that Armageddon to stick? So it could be naming counterspell with meddling mage. It could be tapping down their second blue source. It could be sacking a land to safekeeper so you can go down a land, so you can get a wasteland, so you can waste an Adarkar waste so your Armageddon sticks. It could be trying to double spell Terrigen or Terravor and Sylvan Library so they spend their turn going swords, disenchant, and then they don't have counterspell magic up anymore. So it's the strategy is the thing that makes you win. Tactics is the mechanics of getting mm-hmm. you to your strategy.
Yeah.
Does that make sense?
Yeah, I think that's a pretty good.
Yeah.
The way I generally would say is that just the tactical stuff is the moment to moment, and the strategy is the big picture stuff. The moment to moment stuff is most likely stuff that you're only ever going to really get practice with through reps. You know, you're only really gonna, like, you can tell yourself without playing a game of Magic, hey, don't forget your squee triggers, idiot, as many times as you want, but it really is only going to be after forgetting your squee triggers many times that you're gonna be like, oh, I need to, like, not forget those.
You know who's good at that? Nick. Doesn't forget. I still use the crutch of using dice on my deck.
Yes, which is something
great,
else we can...
Honestly, and that's a great way to do it.
It is a great way, and we can touch on that, and small little tips like that. But having... and I'd say that is kind of like a almost like a technical heuristic.
It is a heuristic. Yeah. It absolutely is
a
heuristic.
Of like saying, hey, I need to... make sure that I don't forget this trigger, so I'm going to put something there to remind myself. And that is offloading the, you know, we talked about yes. offloading decisions and offloading yep. mental bandwidth. You're not having to remember that, because when you go to draw, you're going to say, oh, hey, there's a dice on top of my deck. Why is that there?
Yep.
So I think that I is very important.
I don't know if it's a heuristic specifically, but it goes in the same bucket yeah. as heuristics yes. of behaviors that you can engage in to make W's.
Yes, to yep. to make to offload
yeah.
Your mental capacity.
One of the things too that I'm like not really kind of seeing in the outline, but mm-hmm. I've always, I guess now I'm realizing, like, a way that you learn to get tactical advantages mm-hmm. in a game is by losing.
Mm-hmm.
Right, like missing your squee trigger
mm-hmm.
and then losing the game because of it.
Oh yeah, yeah.
is like a learning experience that yes. you have sure. that builds yeah. you up to not miss squee triggers in the future.
Yep.
And I remember, like, when I started playing Legacy in 2009, I lost so much before I started winning.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
And when I started playing Pre-Modern again much later, I lost a really good amount before yeah. I started winning. And by that point, I was accustomed to losing. You know, and that's something that, you know, I don't really see it in the show notes, but it just kind of popped into my mind, is that, like, you have to lose a lot
mm-hmm.
in order to build up these technical and...
I think the strategic
gameplay.
I think that it's not just necessarily... Like, losing is a fantastic way to learn. And, yeah, not just for, like, oh, I missed it, but I certainly... remember missing triggers for specific things, and it's like, Jesus, I can't do that. That's just, that lost me the game, and you yep. won't forget that trigger after that yeah. point.
Aether, taking up an Aether Vial. That was my big one.
Oh yeah. Oh yeah. For sure.
Yeah.
But I think there's also a lot to be learned strategically from, like, the first time that I got, you know, that I was playing against Targeddon, and I got Geddon, and I went, I just can't win the game.
Yeah.
You know, I didn't necessarily. Now, one of the so at that point I was like, geez, that's what matters.
Yeah.
That, you know, every single counterspell that I have in my hand, that needs to be saved for Ageddon, because all the other small stuff doesn't matter.
Mm-hmm.
I think that it's one of the skills of a very, very good player, that some of the best players have, is, especially at tournaments, obviously this doesn't apply so much to Pre-Modern, but at larger competitive events outside of Pre-Modern, very often tournaments are open deck list. So beginning of the match, you exchange deck lists with your opponent, and you're able to look over and see what they're playing. Even if your opponent is not playing some, like, stock meta deck, the best players are able to look at those deck lists for just a couple of minutes and immediately identify what cards matter. And a lot of that just has to do with understanding how games of Magic play out and how their own decks function. But a lot of that is learned from losing. from losing and saying, okay, how, what axes does my deck crumble under?
I think just learning that it's okay to lose is just so important, because you, I 100%. See players coming back into Magic and coming into pre-modern and jamming, and they might just be hanging out at a dress crew weekly,
mm-hmm.
and they're losing and they're getting really frustrated, mm-hmm. and upset, and it's like, dog, you're gonna have to lose, like, you're new to this,
mm-hmm.
you're gonna have to lose for a while until you start winning, and that is a really,
maybe not so much with pre-modern, but I do feel like a lot of that, and this goes back to the whole mindset conversation, I feel like a lot of that also has to do with Magic Arena.
Kids these days.
I agree. I know. Magic Zoomers that grew up on playing Arena, but like...
No attention span.
I don't want to work anymore. Be like, we were perfect.
They don't
want to
work anymore.
They don't want to work anymore.
They don't want to work anymore.
I agree.
So I'm going to charge them rent.
I have this huge, and maybe I'm projecting, that this entire tangent could be entirely me just projecting, but I struggle when I play Arena because of the way that the game is set up, that it is, you know, as soon as I'm losing, I can just, I quit and then queue into another game.
Yeah.
And there's no, because it's just so fire and forget like that, there's no clawing back, you know, a victory after I was, you know, down and really, you know, and really disadvantaged in the game. I can just, okay, I'm losing. Sure. Fine. Screw it. And then just continue to fire bullets until I win and get that sick dopamine rush of, ooh, yay, the pretty little fireworks are going off. I won.
Yeah.
And I think that, that outlook of getting absolutely nothing from your losses and just, hey, give me that dopamine hit of a win. Give me a dopamine hit of a win. You know, it's like hitting a slot machine.
I do that when I'm tired,
mm-hmm.
in a tournament, or I like don't want to do the mental, or I'm just out of gas. I don't, mm-hmm. I am demotivated, and like maybe it's round 8,
mm-hmm.
and it's like, this is not a flaw to be exhausted. I'm not being too hard on myself.
Yeah, yeah.
But I will be like, all right, this is a one lander, and I'm going all in.
But fuck it.
I'm going all in, and I'm gonna hope that I can go like double mocks,
mm-hmm.
library, or yeah, double mocks library, and then hope to rip my white source.
Yeah.
Or no, I'm being dumb.
Yeah,
but whatever. Just
yeah.
like keeping.
If
like
I go runner,
like super,
I can win
yeah,
this, and,
yeah.
and it would feel so cool.
Yeah, I'm giving shit examples,
yeah,
but
yeah,
like
yeah.
just going like I'm going to keep when I'm tired, I keep ultra risky hands.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And I think that's kind of related, where you're just like seeking the relief, mm-hmm. of getting away from making difficult decisions.
I agree with that.
Yeah.
And I think that's a pretty good segue into the fourth and final aspect of Magic, which is going to be luck.
Right after this commercial break.
Right after this break.
And we're back.
I don't remember what we were talking about.
Just like that.
Just like that.
It was the last topic?
Yeah, so talking about luck.
That's
luck.
What we're moving on to.
So,
Lady Luck.
Lady Luck. So we've kind of broached the three other main aspects of a tournament, being, to remind you, in the, and this is more to remind myself, but deck selection, strategic play, technical play, luck. So luck is the one area that you can't control. And that's okay.
That's okay. It has to be okay.
It has to be okay. And honestly, I think this is something that a lot of people really need to internalize, but variance is a part of Magic. And if you're not okay with that, I recommend you start learning chess and it probably reevaluate your relationship with Magic, because variance is what allows, in Magic, the worst player to beat a better player. You know, the better player is not going to win 100% of the time.
The worst player in the room wins a Magic tournament all the time.
That is true. It certainly has happened. And there are going to be tournaments that you show up to where you mulligan every single round at least once, where you just get paired into the absolute worst matchups that, you know, were a sliver of the metagame and not ones that you were prepared for, and not why you chose to play a deck because you thought it was attacking the big three and you were confident that, you know, if that's what you played against, you were going to rip through those decks. And then you played into a couple of tier three decks
over and over again,
and they just beat you up. That's going to happen, and it's okay. That's why it's important, like everything we said, to set goals that are not hinging on a single tournament, that aren't, that allow you to feel like you made steps towards accomplishing those goals, even if you have a string of bad luck. It's going to swing up, it's going to swing down. You'll have really good runs of just being like, wow, every single time I felt like I needed to draw a certain card, I drew that card. And I think the important thing to hone in on when it comes to luck is that in Magic, you're going to have games where no matter what you did, no matter what decisions you made, you weren't going to win those games. On the other hand, though, you're going to have games where luck is going to put you in a position where you're able to capitalize on the position that you're in order to win. So making sure that when variance is on your side, that's when you strike and that's when you capitalize. I think that's a really important thing to keep in mind, that sometimes just not going to happen, and that's fine. That's okay.
That we were talking about what we can and can't control.
Mm-hmm.
And one of the ways, and this is just from like a scientific standpoint, like design of experiments, is that you can't eliminate luck, but you can restrict
mm-hmm.
its influence.
For sure.
And as far as I understand, one of the only ways you can do that is by playing a lot of tournaments.
Mm-hmm.
And then like assessing yourself over the long term. And you can end up with like, oh, holy shit, I'm a 72% on this deck. Mm-hmm. I fucking rip.
Oh, yeah.
And like maybe that doesn't turn into tournament wins, but you're like, oh, shit, like I played 5 tournaments this year and I top 8ed 4 of them.
Yeah. Fuck yeah. Oh, yeah. And over the long term, it will turn into tournament wins, you know, if you're playing above average.
But you can also, like, leverage this in the opposite direction. Like, maybe you moved to a new city that doesn't have, like, an active PM scene. And maybe you only get to play 1 tournament a year, so you don't have time or resources to practice that much. Maybe you're at sea a lot, so you don't get to play even in the, like, Facebook webcam shit.
Mm-hmm.
So, like, all right, you know what? Fuck it. I'm going to play Fluctuator. Because then that's, mm-hmm. like, that you're maximizing luck,
mm-hmm.
yep. choosing an ultra high variance deck,
for sure.
And that might even be
for sure
the right call.
There's actually, this is kind of related to something I was talking about with somebody the other night, about the concept of, and this could be something that I'm not really like well versed on, and I don't know if anybody have like written really articles about this or whatever, but the concept of high and low variance hands.
Yeah.
And how susceptible different people are to keeping those hands. But like, imagine a hand in any random deck where, say, you have a one lander
mm-hmm.
and you have a perfect curve.
Yeah.
And it's, if you just draw, you know, you're on the draw, and if you draw your second land, that's your second color source or whatever, you are just going to curve out and there's a 90% chance you're going to win the game because mm-hmm. it's just like your hand is perfect. But if you don't draw that card, then you're probably a 10%, 15% yeah. dog in the matchup. That is a very high variance card, or a high variance hand, where you are essentially coin flipping – mm-hmm. your entire game on, am I going to draw this card? Now, the best players are able to look at this in terms of raw math and mm-hmm. say, okay, well, how many colored sources do I have in the deck? How many turns yeah. do I have to draw? You know, how many draw steps do I have?
Yep.
What exactly are my odds? But the real question is, though, is even if those odds are 51%,
mm-hmm.
are you still going to, especially if you're in a high, you know, you're at the Pro Tour.
Yeah.
Are you going to risk your entire tournament life on a 51% odds?
I mean, if
it's statistically, you should, you know, well, it is
in the finals. Yeah. But in round one,
you know, so yeah. you probably are not going to take or a random individual might not take a high variance hand there, but and might instead try and mulligan down for a much lower variance that, like, okay, I would rather take my shot with a random six card hand where I'm maybe on average 45% to beat my opponent's yeah. seven card hand versus this 51% shot to just mm-hmm. instantly win the game.
Yeah.
Mm.
I think that's just a really interesting dynamic, and I think it opens up a really interesting conversation about how everyone has different tolerances for variance.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And that was kind of, you mentioning Fluctuator is what kind of put me yeah. over to this, just because some people don't have that sort of tolerance for variance.
Yep.
And that's okay. Yeah. It's something like that can be very, very swingy, where if you run hot, you can just absolutely dunk on people. But alternatively, some people are just absolute agency cucks, where they're like, oh, I need to be cantripping and sculpting and have agency at every moment in the game. And, you know, the answer probably lies somewhere in the middle as for what the optimal solution is. But also, I think, in some cases, agency is a trap. But that's a whole nother topic.
For the next time, right?
For the next time, for the next time, exactly.
Jay drives.
Overall, just kind of recapping, we talked about setting goals. We talked about using those goals that you set to help orient a more positive mindset. We talked about the four aspects of a tournament and how you can prepare for those aspects, be it in deck selection, getting that locked in, preparing your strategic play and figuring out how you want to how you want to manipulate certain matchups and make sure that you can drive certain games into a more favorable play, into more favorable play patterns. That's what I was looking to say. Technical play, how you can just practice. And then luck, which is just always going to be a part of the game. I had a couple of other small little things. If you're preparing for a tournament, make sure you take care of yourself. Tournaments are long. They are exhausting. Have a plan for food.
Are we going to self-care right now?
Yeah, we're going to self-care. Okay, cool. A little bit of self-care. Have a plan for food. Have a plan for water. Bring some Advil. Bring enough Advil for the homies, too. You know, if you're, like we were talking about earlier, if you're able to, you know, in between rounds, hey, you need an Advil, you need something, you know, help out your homies. Do you guys have any other tips for preparing for tournaments or whatever?
Good night's sleep is
It's huge. A huge one. That's a huge one. I can never absolutely sleep before huge. A big tournament. I always struggle.
Yeah.
I'll stay awake at night and just, it sucks, but
I would say just like jam in a couple hands. Like if you can show up like just like 15 minutes before and just like, just goldfish a couple hands. Mm.
Just kind of get yourself in the...
Oh, I find, like, yeah, it that, like, when I sit down and I'm about to play, I'm like, what am I even fucking doing here? Like, I just, like, I'm... And just having, like, not to exhaust yourself, but just to, like, get...
Just to warm up your hand. Dude, when you sit down and, like, your hands are frigid, and like, you're shuffling up for round one and just, like, your hands are just, like, numb as you're mashing cards together, I hate that.
Yeah. I actually have a kind of a regimen for my tournament prep, like the day of.
Okay. Yeah, yeah, yeah.
I always bring two Nalgenes with me.
Okay.
And one of them has electrolytes in it. I bring an extra coffee with me.
Mm-hmm.
And so this is like for obviously like the Massachusetts stuff where it's like, you know, I have the luxury of like parking a car. LobsterCon's a whole different story. Mm-hmm. Yeah, but at these at these Massachusetts tournaments, two Nalgenes, an extra coffee. And then either the night before or the morning of, I'll stop by Ed Heider's Mediterranean Market and pick up, you know, a stuffed pita and some nice salads and stuff like that. Yeah.
I get anchovies, so I have, like, fishy breath for my opponents. Yeah, just catch me outside smoking, eating anchovies.
Just being a foul creature.
How many packs of Black and Milds do you need to stock up before a tournament? Like
at LC, I was, like... Either the rounds are very long.
That's true.
So I could probably go through like seven.
Seven packs?
Not packs, oh, okay. But like
seven individual Black and Milds. Yeah, okay.
At LC was well more than a pack.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But yeah, so I basically have a cooler in my car and I have electrolytes and I have water and I have food throughout the day so that I don't have to eat pizza or whatever. Like I like to have like, you know, good nutritious food that's not going to make me feel like shit.
Yeah.
And maybe a little chocolate or something like that, you know, just hit the sweet tooth later in the day.
Balanced macros.
Yeah.
But just like a little bit of protein. Just make sure that you're hitting protein, fat, and carbohydrate.
Yeah. And this is something that I learned, though, because it's like I was showing up to these tournaments with like just a single Nalgene and basically no food.
Oh, yeah.
And you get to the end of it and you're just so famished and hungry. Mm-hmm. Yeah. And maybe you had to buy the ELD pizza and now your stomach is killing you and you like feel like shit.
And you have to poop.
Yeah.
In their tiny store in the middle of the bathroom.
Right.
Yeah. Yeah, I think that just making sure that you give yourself every single little edge to be comfortable and be not starving and exhausted.
Dude, when you have that coffee in like round four or five, it's just so insane. It hits. Your opponent is just sitting there so gassed and you're just, you know, fueling up on caffeine and something warm and everything. It's just amazing.
Yeah, eating your cashews and craisins.
Right.
With a nice coffee.
Yep.
Yeah.
I know that Nick does like the power bars. He's always got those. Like
Nick has the six packs of electrolyte drink that he always brings.
Also, I'm sure any tournament regular knows all this stuff, but like, you know, pack your bag the night before. Make sure you have your dice, you know, have all your stuff.
Yeah.
One thing I will say...
Have your fucking deck sleeved.
Yeah.
You fucks.
That's true. One thing that actually kind of goes with just being prepared, that this goes less into preparation and more into actual while playing a match, but if you have a bunch of tokens for your deck, and they're in your deck box, and you play a card that makes a token, you grab a token. While you're in your deck box, grab all your fucking tokens and pull them out. Because if you're the person that played, like, if you cast a Call of the Herd, and you grab one elephant token out of your box, and then you flash it back, and you go back and have to open up your deck box again to dig out another token, fuck you.
One elephant's always enough. I don't ever need to do it.
That's fair. But, yeah, make sure, like, just that tiny little, like, I'm not saying that you're going to time because you didn't take all your tokens out, but, like, it's those small little shortcuts that is huge in making sure that the round goes much more seamlessly.
Actually, I'd like to amend my previous answer. One elephant is enough because it's getting dominated at end step, and then...
And then it's their deal. They need the token.
and then they're dust bowling my green source, so there will never be a second. So that's why I don't.
Yeah, and then you just die to your own elephant token.
Yeah.
That's fair.
Talk about the bad beats.
Yeah.
Yeah. People don't forget, I'm coming for you. Cool.
So I think that about does it for my topic of tournament preparation. But do we have any other anything else that we want to do or talk about?
Did you guys want to talk about the meta at all?
Predictions
and stuff like that? I mean, but it sounds like
The regional?
So
the regional I am going to win on Survival Terrigan.
So
that's my prediction.
Okay.
Now that we're prepared, all the listeners are ready and eager to go into the next tournament. With those big tournaments being our regional in a couple of days and LobsterCon in 2 months, right?
Yep.
Yeah, do we want to talk about predictions? What do we think is going to win or do well? Do we think any decks are going to overperform, underperform?
I'm just realizing that we have like a somewhat of a localized audience for New England, and we can actually just fucking spoil. If like we don't like somebody, we can just be like, yeah, they're on this. Yeah they have whatever in their sideboard.
Talk
about petty.
People got targets on their backs for sure.
Do not cross us. We will leak your tech.
Yeah, it's true.
I mean, looking at the last regional, we saw for the first time Dreadnought hogging the meta share, mm-hmm. having a larger meta share than Sly.
I think Sly's only going to keep going down.
Yeah, and so with Sly being in a poor position as of late, like there was like maybe two people on it at the 49 person Massachusetts Monthly. It was the second highest played deck at the last regional, but did not convert at all. I don't know if anybody in Massachusetts is really brewing on black, but I think that, as I said in the last episode, that black has a good shot at overperforming mm-hmm. at this next tournament. And the other deck that I think has a good shot at overperforming is Mud/Tinker/Devourer Variance.
Mm-hmm.
We saw two of those in the top eight as Billy shakes his head at me. There was two of them in the top eight at the last Massachusetts Monthly.
Drew was playing...
He was playing a Devourer Variant.
With Oath.
And then somebody was playing Welder Tinker.
At the Monthly?
Yep.
Oh, that's the CPS.
Was victorious against that other gentleman.
Yeah.
Yes.
I'm not saying that it's going to win the whole thing, but I think that with Sly being absent from the meta, players should be going into this tournament thinking about the decks that underperform against Sly and overperform against the rest of the meta.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that maybe the extremely proficient Burn/Sly pilots should be thinking about mounting their comeback and capitalizing on this.
Yeah, but with Dreadnought being such a huge part of the meta,
right?
It's a tough ask, right. In my opinion.
I think the overperforming decks in order are going to be Terrageddon, Mono Blue Dreadnought, Replenish, Survival Rock.
Wow. Daring, aren't we, Billy? Wow. We're so daring today.
What did we just
deviating
do? We just
from
said,
the data.
We just no. That's that.
I know. I know. Yeah. That was the joke.
Well, so Black Green Survival is actually another deck that's been pretty largely absent in Massachusetts. Like we went down to Rochester.
Yeah.
There was so much Black Green Survival everywhere, and then you play in the Massachusetts Monthly with 49 people last week, and it's like, I don't even know if there was a single person in the
room.
There was
one. It was Chris Roy.
Yeah. There's like one person on it. So
there's
a lot of decks that have been absent from the metagame that I think have the opportunity to capitalize on the absence specifically like of Burn and also Goblins.
Oh, I want to have a small rant.
Sure.
And This is biased by the I am displaying journalistic bias by choosing what to cover and what not to, but this is not based on favorability bias. So this is expressive bias, but not, I don't know how to say it. I'm talking about it because I'm biased. I don't hold my opinion because I'm biased.
Okay.
If your deck is the top rated deck on the Duress Crew data project, it's not a tier 2 deck.
Yeah, I would.
Sure. If it is the top deck, it's not tier 2. Just hard.
I would.
Terrageddon is not a tier 2 deck. I'm not playing.
Anybody saying that?
Some people are.
Yeah.
Oh yeah. Oh yeah.
Well, they're wrong.
They are wrong.
Yeah.
And they're doing it based on vibes. We have the data. Don't listen to them. Listen to us.
It's true.
Yeah.
True.
That sounds like shots fired. But anyway, that's blah, 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 blah. That. Yeah. No. That was. This is about my peeve. Not about the journalistic skill of other people who like have better leads and better stories than us quite frequently. By that, I mean most of the time.
I will say the other deck, too, that's kind of not been around much is Oath. specifically red green or green white Ponza Oath. Like,
I don't think it's good.
Deck seems dead in the water right now. That is another deck that is an Achilles heel, you know, for a lot of these aggro.
Straight up play the white version.
Yeah, really?
Maybe. Yeah. If Oath Ponza is bad, play the white version, because then you get Ray in the sideboard.
Hmm.
And that I think is good against Replenish, and you have the main deck Swords against Dreadnought.
Mm-hmm.
So if Oath Ponza decks in general are bad because they fuck so hard on go wide,
mm-hmm.
play the white version, because then you're better against Dreadnought, because you have, like, you can sit
and
down.
Go wide is much more
exactly,
or is, like, much less prevalent than
that. Exactly. And like, you can do the math about, like, pre-board, post-board games, but it's better to have four swords main,
mm-hmm.
Than just two naturalized main.
Yeah.
And then post-board, you have four swords.
Four
is greater than two.
We do the hard-hitting math here.
Exactly. I'm not a mathematician or anything, but four is approximately plus or minus greater than two.
The last deck that I'll mention that was totally absent from our last regional is Elves. There was a strong showing of Elves this past week at the Massachusetts Monthly.
Yep.
It was completely absent before, with Oath being not represented in the format right now. They have, like, one super bad matchup in Replenish, and then the rest of the field seems pretty good for them. So I could totally see Elves also breaking out and, you know, sneaking at least one copy into top eight. Nick Mayo notably not playing in the tournament. But
in the monthly? He top eighted this.
No, in the regional
coming up.
But there's some other killers out there, so
I think people desperately want to play that deck, but it's hugely price locked.
Yeah,
like, let's not fuck around the issue.
It's just a cool, these days it's so cool $650 to $700 to get your survivals and cradles and gold border.
In gold. Wow.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's nuts.
Yep. So, I don't know. That's pretty much all that I wanted to cover for
this topic.
Just a little light touch upon what's coming up and what people should be thinking about.
For sure.
You guys want to do some listener mail?
Yeah. So, I heard that we have a little voicemail to listen to.
Yeah. I'm going to play it here, and Ben's going to work his audio magic so it doesn't sound like shit. So, nobody talk, because this next 14 seconds
is about... He can just cut it.
Well, that's what I'm saying. True.
Yeah, cut it in.
Well, but
we're gonna listen to it live.
Well, what I'm saying is,
play the clip.
Yeah, don't talk.
Howdy, homies! It's Crazy Carl. Just leaving a voicemail because I don't know how to make a comment on Spotify because I'm a tech boomer. Love the show. Keep it up. You guys are doing a great job.
And we don't know how to mute our podcast because we're also tech boomers.
Hell yeah, Carl! Thank you so much for that voicemail. So
this is the first time we've played one on air.
Yeah, we've got a couple, but this is the first one we've played on air. Thank you for leaving it. If you want to leave us a voicemail, I'll leave a link for the SpeakPipe. You can talk shit. You can offer corrections.
Oh yeah.
You can troll us. We don't care. Leave us some voicemail.
Tell me how I just, like, yapped for the past hour.
How good all of my takes were because you confused me with Jay.
True. Yeah. Every time I said something smart, it was Brad that said it.
Yep. Yeah. You can attack our insecurities. You can fact check us. You can flex on us. I don't care.
No flex.
Zone. Cool. Do we have any shout outs? Upcoming events?
We already touched the beginning on the raffle, but other than that, we have the upcoming Dress Crew Regional.
Tune in on Twitch.
Yes. If you want to play in it, too bad.
Too bad,
sucker. It's sold out. But you can still follow along all the action on Twitch, twitch.tv/Dress Crew. I'll be streaming the entire event. I think me and Tony are going to be doing commentary again with probably some special guests from some other people.
I'll be rotating through the booth.
Well, yeah,
I won't be. Because you'll be commenting my games.
Yeah.
True. Yeah. You'll be watching Billy.
And we got some upgrades this time in the form of a spice rack and being able to pull up deck lists. And
yes, we're going to have
a lot of cool shit going on. We're always trying to step up our game. We have hand-painted top eight cards
that
look really cool. So, yeah, a lot of cool shit coming up. And as ever, we're always trying to step up our game and do something even better. So, yeah, I'm excited.
Hell yeah.
I think that's it for me, though. I mean, don't know. There's a lot going on, and it's tough to always keep up with all of it these days. So
for sure.
All right. I'm good.
Cool. Signing off.
All right. Peace out, everybody.
Peace.
Bye.